I want to welcome everyone to the Lunch and Learn sponsored by the Campus Community Committee. I don't know about other people here, but over the past couple of years, I listen to the radio in the morning mostly because of the weather. It's been so erratic, and therefore I want to know how I should dress or how I should not dress before I head out for the day. And I found this morning quite interesting in the sense that they reported and they said it was going to be 7 degrees above normal. Now, for many of you, that's 13 degrees above normal, if you're back to the Fahrenheit scale. But it was 7 degrees above normal. My natural question, of course, is what is normal itself? Do we define it? Is it something that keeps on shifting? And that's why I thought that today's talk would, in fact, be particularly relevant, talking about global warming and climate change itself. And we're very fortunate to have one of the world's experts in that field, Lawrence Mizak, with us here today to sort of give us information and help us clarify what is really happening out there in the direction in which we are going. I could give a very long introduction for Lawrence, but I'll be quite brief itself. Lawrence came to McGill in 1986 as a Canada Steamship Lines professor in meteorology. That's when he had a department of meteorology. He is currently a professor emeritus in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. He's been in McGill since 86. He's a graduate first of University of Alberta, then he went to school in Australia for some reason where he got his master's, followed up with a PhD and a master's at Harvard. He's a climate scientist, he's an oceanographer, he's an applied mathematician, and he has many, many kudos to his name. He's a member of the Order of Canada, he's received the Governor General's Jubilee Award, he's received the Prix Marie Victorin, which is one of the Prix de Québec, very, very prestigious in Quebec. And mostly, many people at the university know him as sort of a long-standing member of the Royal Society, a fellow of the Royal Society who's encouraged McGill to nominate people to the Royal Society. I could keep on talking and talking, but I think you'd rather hear what Lawrence has to say about the topic of climate change. Where on earth are we going? Lawrence.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Berlofsky. Climate change from here to eternity. First of all, what is climate? There's a lot of confusion, including by our government leaders, the difference between climate and weather. Weather is the day-to-day stuff. It's warm today. A few days ago, it was very cold. So that's the weather. The climate is the average of the weather at a given place at a given time or season. So winter, we expect over the course of the winter in Montreal, say 2 meters of snow. How much have we had so far?
Very little,
that's right. So we're way below average. We expect it to be a lot of snow and a lot of cold temperatures. So the weather is day-to-day stuff, and a very short definition of the difference between climate and weather is the climate is what you expect and the weather is what you get. Simple as that. Well, I'm going to give you a very long perspective on climate change. Before I really want to talk about the here and the future, I want to also talk about the past, because we can learn so much of what is happening today in terms of past climate and climate changes. So I have an outline. This is a canned talk. I've given this talk many times before. Normally I would invite questions, but I believe you are scheduled to a fairly tight time, so I'll try and move along. But after an introduction exposing you to the wide range of climate history, I'll focus on the last million years, because I think we're familiar during the last million years is the time that we've had the ice ages, the sort of 100,000-year ice age cycles. And one of the stories I'm going to tell you today is that those are history. We're never going to have another ice age again. So the good news, we're not going to have 3 kilometers of ice over Montreal in whatever, 50,000 or 100,000 years. Then the present climate, of course, revolves around the Industrial Revolution, what started off the gradual warming that we've had. And so we've come to today, and the question is, okay, if the trends in CO2 in the atmosphere and so on continue, where will we go? What are the likely climates of the future? And again, we cannot say with certainty what will happen because it depends so much on our own behavior. And I'll talk about that as well. But the future climates, I'm not only just going to talk about the 100 years, I'm really going to go into the future 100,000 years and even beyond. Okay, do you really care? Well, maybe not, but it's a fascinating intellectual topic. impacts of climate change, well, I think you've heard a lot about that. I'll go over that briefly and then just present a few conclusions. Okay, Earth's temperature, this is a very crude picture of what the Earth has been over the last 4 billion years plus. And what you see there is warm, red, cold at the bottom. And we speak of, the geologists would speak of the Earth's history being made up of either ice houses or greenhouses, sometimes called hot houses. And basically an ice house is when you have ice sheets, permanent ice sheets around, big ice sheets, like Greenland ice sheet, like Antarctica ice sheet. And the first one occurred, this thing is too lively for me. The first one occurred around 2 billion years ago, the first for the See the Sign ice house. And then it was warm for a while, and then there was quite a big cold period lasting about 50 million years. And that was known as the snowball Earth, when the continents are actually closer to the center of the planet, that is the equator, and we had a lot of ice and ice sheets around. Then it was warm for a bit, then it was cold again. So the last ice house was about 300 billion years ago, and that's when all the continents were together, Pangaea, one super huge continent. Then it was warm for 200 million years, and then about 2-3 million years ago, we slid into another ice house. So yes, we are in an ice house. Despite all this talk about warming, it is an ice house because we've got Greenland, and we've got Antarctica. Okay, so what are the reasons for these big swings, these multi-million year swings between the cold periods and the warm periods? One obvious one that people refer to is, well, maybe the solar constant, this is the amount of heat coming from the sun, has gone up and down on this multi-million year time scale. Well, the astrophysicists say, no, that's not the case. They say the sun has actually been getting stronger. It was very weak a long time ago, and yet it was very warm. Probably because of a lot of greenhouse gases. So greenhouse gases, we hear a lot about carbon dioxide and so on. Are the greenhouse gases going up and down on this time scale? And the answer to that is partly yes, but we can only go back to about 500 million years ago. In studies by Berner, he's a geochemist from Yale, looking at very clever records, they could deduce that compared to the pre-industrial value of concentration of CO2, namely 280 parts per million, so that's a unit of one on the scale, so there's 10 times, 20 times. So during that very warm period in here, indeed, the greenhouse gas CO2 was at a very high level, you know, nearly 20 times the pre-industrial. So maybe that's why that was so warm. And then during the ice house of 300 million years ago, during this time, indeed, the CO2 was back down, and then things warmed up again, and greenhouse gases were quite high during the time of the dinosaurs, and then we slid down to the pre-industrial value. Where did these gases come from? Why did they change? Well, it's all through what is known as biogeochemical cycles, very long time scale, biogeochemical, lovely big word, but it involves everything. It involves life, the geology, the chemistry, and the physics. And where a lot of these gases came from is from the interior of the Earth. So the Earth stores a lot of carbon. It bubbles up through mid-Atlantic ridges, and you have mantle convection. The dinosaurs obviously loved it, and they had a great time during that time. So this is the Cretaceous, the peak of the dinosaur period. Another interesting factor is that there's something called continental drift. And the continents come together and open up and come together on a time scale of about 500 million years. And certainly at the time of the dinosaurs 100 million years ago, we had a very different configuration. There was virtually no, some Atlantic Ocean in the north, but virtually no South Atlantic. This is actually pretty well blocked off. Here's poor India stranded way down south, Australia connected to Antarctica, and so on. So what difference does that make? Well, the climate at any given period depends very much on the oceans and the ocean circulation. And there's a very famous ocean circulation known as the conveyor belt, the thermohaline circulation. It's a global circulation driven by temperature differences between the cold north regions and the equatorial regions. And this conveyor belt looks like this. This is one sort of artist's rendition. And the importance of the circulation, which is global, is that it does transport heat from low latitude to the high. And in fact, you can see the heat is going from the southern hemisphere to the north in the Atlantic. But in the Pacific, the heat is actually just going the other way. So there's a balance, a thermal balance, bringing heat from one hemisphere to the other with this global circulation pattern. This is a very slow circulation. The turnaround time, if I dropped something which would stay with a water particle and then sink down to the bottom here of the ocean, go through the bottom, and then upwell in the Pacific and come back again, the time scale of that is of the order of 1,000 years. So that's a very slow but very important circulation pattern. What's the other circulation pattern you're more familiar with? The Gulf Stream, right? The Gulf Stream gyres. So those are sort of superimposed on top. And these are sort of fairly fast circulation. So here's the Gulf Stream gyre. Also transports some heat towards Europe and also helps to warm Europe. So if you imagine now that the Atlantic Ocean is squeezed out, the continents are all together, as was the case 100 million years ago, then there would not be any conveyor belt in the Atlantic Ocean. So that circulation had to change. So the whole configuration of how heat was transported by the oceans would have changed. Okay, so now I'm coming up. By the way, if you can see this at the bottom here, I'm still in the introduction, so if you're getting a little bit tired, and when am I going to finish, just see where I am along here, and you'll know that the end is coming soon. So this is a picture of data. It's an oxygen ratio of heavy oxygen 18 to light oxygen 16, and this data is taken from sediment cores in the ocean, and basically, the bigger the number here, the more global ice mass we have. And the reason is quite subtle, but basically when you have ice sheets around, what happens is that the lighter water moves to higher latitudes and the heavier oxygen, the 18, stays down below. So this ratio, therefore, is large when you've got a lot of the heavy stuff below and all the light water has gone to the north to make ice sheets. So that's a simple interpretation of this record. So what you see here is that the ice mass is bubbling up and down, and then gradually we got more and more ice, and also we got more and more regular patterns, and indeed, as time moves to the right here, we can see that we have our 100-age ice age cycles. Here is the last ice age peak. That was at about 120,000 years ago. We came out of the ice age into the warm period, and now we're going back down, perhaps into the we're into the warm period here. This is the peak of the ice age. Here is the last warm period. So mass is up, so warm is down here. So one of the fundamental questions is, well, why did we go from this rather small amount of ice wiggles, high-frequency wiggles, to the slower oscillations? That's a great challenge of climate theorists today. It's not a topic that I'm an expert in, but it may relate to the greenhouse gases. It may relate to, again, biogeochemical changes. But the reason we have these very regular cycles is very precisely due to the so-called orbital parameter changes. The fact that the Earth tilts on a time scale of about 40,000 years through a couple of degrees. Not a lot, but that's enough to affect the seasonality and the change. Also, the Earth's orbit is elliptical, so sometimes it's a very long ellipse, and other times it's almost circular. And finally, there's a change in the seasonality. Some summers were close to the sun, and some summers were far to the sun. So those have times of 20, 40, 100,000 years and longer. And when you put all those together, we can actually forecast this cycle of ice ages quite well. Okay, so now there's hope here. So we're now into the past, the recent past. We finished our introduction. So the past is looking now more closely at this last roughly 1 million years. Again, here's the same delta 18O you saw before. Now I've reversed the direction of this curve, so mass is down. So this means that here we have the last ice age, and here we've come out of it. And I've done that because I've plotted now the temperature, which comes from another isotope of hydrogen that gives a record of temperature. And you can see that up and down with these 100,000-year ice age cycles, the temperature is up when we had less ice, more ice, it was cold, and so on. And again, from direct measurements, not inferring, but from direct measurements of the bubbles in ice cores, we could actually measure the concentration of CO2s. For the ice age cycles back half a million years ago, the CO2 level was around 250, 260, but the last four cycles, it was around 280, And that's what it was 200 years ago, 280 parts per million. So this regular cycle is observed. There's nothing mysterious about it. The temperature went up and down between the ice ages and our present out of the ice age. Temperature changed about 5 degrees. But these temperature changes are not driven by CO2. These temperatures are very much driven by the orbital changes themselves. So it's the shape of the Earth's orbit, the tilt, and the distance from the sun during summer. But nevertheless, the CO2 went up and down because you can imagine if large parts of the Earth are covered by ice, then there's very little space for the vegetation to grow. You take away the ice, vegetation expands. So again, part of the biogeochemical cycles, you have increase and decreases of CO2 with the ice ages. So the CO2 in the past was really amplifying the temperature changes due to purely physical astronomical changes. But today, it's just the other way around. Fascinating time was during an ice age itself. If you just go back briefly, you'll see that there's a lot of sort of fuzzy stuff in here, even between the warm period and the cold period. And those fuzzy curves were really quite violent climate changes, timescales over Greenland of the order of changes of 20 degrees, ocean temperature changes of many degrees. And what happened was at that time when we were covered by ice, there were huge armadas of icebergs going off into the ocean. As the ice sheets get too large, they discharge huge icebergs because they become unstable, the ice sheets. And those icebergs then would flood the ocean with very fresh water. And very fresh water is a stabilizing event. That is, fresh water is very light, low density, and that prevents that famous thermohaline circulation, that water from sinking down. It stabilizes the water column. So, in fact, the THC, the thermohaline circulation, would actually slow down during these very cold periods when all these armadas went out. And then eventually the water got mixed up and the circulation would return and the temperature would go back up. A very fascinating book is by Burroughs here, Climate Change in Prehistory. And he talks about how difficult it must have been to live during this ice age period when, these ice sheets were around, there wasn't a lot of vegetation, it was cold as hell, and, how did people survive? And they just were running around from shelter to survive. And one of the things he talks about is, indeed, how climate probably did affect human migration. So we came out of Africa many million, 150,000 years ago, spread into the Middle East and Orient, down to Australia, and then into Europe, and then finally into North America, maybe 20, 25,000 years ago. So if you're interested in this prehistory, I highly recommend this book by Burroughs, because it also describes the struggles that people must have had. But the fact is, they could not really establish themselves anywhere because the climate was so terrible, so rough. Okay, now coming into the present, this is a time when it was still pretty cold, 1,000 years ago, except 1,000 years ago, maybe it was a little bit warmer, something called the medieval warm period, but we definitely went to a slightly cooler period known as the Little Ice Age, and then starting around 1850 or so, 1900, suddenly the temperature started to take off, and these are the direct temperature measurements. The blue curve is data which is gives an inference of the temperature from things like tree rings, coral records, and so on. So this is the famous hockey stick profile, and I haven't got quite the right hockey stick there, but there is the profile that's been described, or the device that's been used to describe this period. So we see the temperatures rise rapidly and into the present, and again, if you look at measurements of the gases from ice cores, there was a slow rise in the temperature over thousands of years, but all of a sudden, this very rapid rise. This is methane, another greenhouse gas coming from permafrost agriculture, nitrous oxide, another agricultural effect. Again, you can see that there were slow changes in these greenhouse gases, but the change that we've seen in the last 200 years, 150 years, is dramatic. There's no way you can say that this is a natural change. Yes, CO2 has gone up and down in the past, but it's the rate at which these gases have changed which is so significant. Okay, the greenhouse gas. Now a little primer, 101 lecture on the greenhouse effect. We are heated by the sun. The sun provides what's known as shortwave energy, okay? Energy with a lot of little wiggles in it, okay? Distance from peak to peak, very short. And that shortwave energy passes through, for the most part, through the atmosphere. Not much is absorbed. Some of it is reflected, but most of it reaches the Earth, and it produces a surface temperature of TS. So that's why we get sunburns, right? That stuff comes and burns us. And then we feel very warm after. So then what we do, we radiate heat as a black body. And the bigger you are in the girth, the more heat you're going to radiate. You've got this black body, and you will radiate heat at a rate of the temperature to the power 4. That's known as black body radiation. And that outgoing radiation is long wave compared to the incoming short. So this long wave, because it's long wave, it so happens that because of greenhouse gases, that energy is absorbed by the atmosphere. So it warms the atmosphere to a temperature TA, and then that body itself will radiate more energy out to space at a rate of TA to the fourth, the temperature of the atmosphere, and then it'll come down as long wave radiation to warm the Earth's surface. And that is the greenhouse effect. So the greenhouse effect has nothing to do with greenhouses in your backyard with glass ceilings and so on. It's purely a radiation effect that produces this warming. Okay, so clearly a key factor then, so this downward effect then, this downwelling effect, is what warms the Earth to make it very livable today. If we increase these greenhouse gases, we're going to increase the amount of heat coming down to the Earth, and that will produce the so-called enhanced greenhouse effect. So the more CO2, the more heat that's going to be absorbed in the atmosphere, and the more that will come back down. So, continuing with the present here, you can see that this is the observed temperature, global temperature record, over the last now only 150 years. And you can see, yes, there's been some wiggles here. We call this multi-decadal variability. But overall, you can see that certainly since about 1960, the global temperature has gone up of the order of maybe 7/10 of a degree, 3/4 of a degree. The sea level has risen largely because of the thermal expansion of the ocean. So as the atmosphere warms, the ocean warms and expands. And there's a little bit there due to glaciers melting, but it's mainly a thermal expansion effect. Not a lot, but you know, something of the order of a meter there over that time period. Snow cover has disappeared, and certainly today we're way down here somewhere off the graph, so we're certainly seeing a lot less snow recently. So just concentrate for the moment on the black curves. If you look continent by continent, and this comes from IPCC, and I have a reference sheet here, a few copies I made, you're welcome to take, but IPCC stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a international body of scientists that gets together every few years to produce a big report, and the last one was produced in 2007, and what they do is they gather global data just to see how the climate has been changing, and they also do modeling studies to try and see if they can reproduce the present climate with climate models, and finally they make forecasts for the future. But what we're focusing on for the moment is just this black line showing that yes, there is this sort of decadal variability, but on the whole every continent does show a warming over the last 40-50 years. So those are the observations. There's no dispute with that data whatsoever. And I'm sure you have seen your own situations of things like this. Glaciers are disappearing in Alaska, for example. The Arctic sea ice cover reducing. This is kind of an old picture, but the average for these years, much less Arctic sea ice cover. And indeed, in the year 2007, we had a very, very low ice cover, you know, almost half of what you see in the right there. Okay, I'm described as an oceanographer, climate person, applied mathematician. I started out in mathematics and physics. I really wanted to do in general relativity, but I found it too difficult, quite frankly, so I had to abandon that subject and take something more, I thought, applicable and interesting. So I started studying the oceans, the application of math to oceans, and then when I came to McGill is when I started learning about climate system. And the climate system is a multi-component system consisting not just of the atmosphere and the oceans, but the land surface, the vegetation, and the cryosphere. And you can see pictures here of this radiation, outgoing radiation, winds. So these are all sort of dynamic, thermodynamic things. But important aspects are the vegetation, sort of the biogeochemistry of the oceans, the CO2, and vegetation, which also affects the climate in very important ways, because whether you have vegetation or not very much affects the reflectivity, the albedo of the surface. So if we look at just the natural causes of climate change, I've talked about plate tectonics and outgassing producing CO2, changes in the Earth's orbit, these are the so-called orbital changes, and there's also changes in the sun's strength. So these are sort of the natural inputs to cause the climate to change, the average of the weather in a given location. And here's the five components, the atmosphere, vegetation, ice, oceans, and land. And those arrows connect everything to what's possible there. And the upshot is that you have output of the climate in the atmosphere, changes in the sea ice, vegetation, and so on. So that's what I do. I now call myself, in fact, an Earth system science modeler. I look at the interactions of all these different components on different timescales and how different regions are affected. Okay, now I'm going to go back a bit in history. You can't quite see this, Morty, but this is 2001 now, okay? So this is the preceding IPCC report. And in there, they did some model studies where they showed the observations in every case, so the same red curve in every case. And this sort of gray-blue band is climate models run with only natural forcing, solar and volcanic forcing. And you can see there's not a bad simulation of what's happened, but really the warming was not predicted. If you put in greenhouse gases and also aerosols, which tend to cool, then you can see that they sort of underpredict very much what's happening. So if you put everything together, all the forcings, the simulations done, say, over 10 years ago, do a pretty good job. Many models here represented do a pretty good job of simulating the observed climate. Okay, so now let's go back to the previous picture you saw before with these black lines continent by continent. So what you have here, all the blue bands are models with only the natural forcing of solar constant changes and volcanoes. But when you put in the greenhouse gases and aerosols, these purple band here shows you that they are indeed necessary to simulate the past climate. Okay, the future. So now again, I'm jumping back to the last IPCC. Somewhere you should see here it is, IPCC. So this is again 2001. And so what's the forcing? Well, here's the CO2 emissions. This is the carbon emissions. And back in 1990, we were producing 7 gigatons of carbon per year. That was the output of carbon from all our activities, driving cars, heating, and so on and so forth. Do you know what that number is today? Trivial pursuit question. Any idea? It's bigger, smaller? A lot bigger. Do you know how? It's 10 billion today. So already in that short period, we've gone from 7 billion to 10 billion tons. That's a hell of a lot. So obviously there's a lot more industrial activity, a lot more cement being built, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a huge increase. Anyway, way back for this last report here, they started with here and they said, well, we don't know where we're going. And they sure didn't, because here is 210. And in fact, well, even the worst scenarios thought we'd only go to 9. And we indeed overshot and went up to 10 gigatons of carbon. So once you take that carbon, you can convert that to CO2. And so we're obviously above the pre-industrial, which is 280, so that's sort of down here somewhere. So we started with about 350, and depending on how much carbon we're producing, we would end up with CO2 changes from 1,000 down to maybe 500. And the SO2 sulfate emissions, this is the aerosols, which tend to cool the atmosphere. Again, if we have less industrial activity, we get cleaner, then we're going to produce less of those. You put those together for these different scenarios of greenhouse gas emissions, and you come up with a range of temperatures from 4 degrees to maybe about 1.5 degrees. And the sea level rise that they forecast then was, again, in the range of from nearly 1 meter down to about 30, 40 centimeters. So that was the story in 2001. Today, in the last IPCC report, 2007, now starting like from today, which is when they were doing these studies, you can see that even if we kept the CO2 constant, that's the red curve here, there would still be a warming. And that's because the oceans have a tremendous thermal reservoir. They are very slow to warm up, but once you warm up the oceans, they'll continue to warm if the atmosphere is warm, and that will radiate heat. It'll continue to warm the atmosphere. But for the other scenarios, you can see that depending on how much greenhouse gases, the temperature range is still going to be in the range of 1.5 to 3, 3.5 degrees. And if you take into account error bars, then we could be looking at, you know, up to 3, 4 degrees change. Okay, but we don't know where we're going. But suppose we could stop at 600 parts per million at the end of the century. Here we could stop at 850. Here we could stop at 1250. Then what you see here, so this is now very soon, this is an average over the next 10 to 15 years. You can see there is warming here, and that warming orange is a scale of 2, 3 degrees. But that's, you know, for a fairly low level. If we run through to the end of the century, we're going to be talking about warming, even for fairly low CO2. Today we're at 400, so 600 is not that far away. We're going to see temperature increases of, in the high latitudes, temperatures of, you know, 4 or 5 degrees. And if we keep going 850 and 1250, then temperatures are going to be very, very warm at high latitudes. Not so much in the lower latitude oceans, but still some warming. So we're going to see a lot of warming by these climate models. And right now, work is underway to produce the next assessment, and that will appear in 2013. And it's actually led by one of my former postdoctoral students who started his climate research here at McGill, Dr. Thomas Stocker from Bern. So he is the scientific leader of the next IPCC report. And so you're going to see more coming out in about 3, 4 years' time. So IPCC, it's available on the website at Bern, Switzerland. And so take one of those pieces of paper, you can get the actual website. So the projections then. Temperature is up to 4 degrees. Ideally, people say we should try and stop things down to about 2 degrees to prevent, you know, really drastic results. But regional changes are going to be huge, and we've certainly seen these already in the West and in the Arctic. Sea level rise, we're a bit off the map there, but I think we're revisiting that, as I'll talk about later. And why we're going to revisit that is because things are happening much faster in Greenland, that big ice sheet sitting, you know, to the east of us and north of us. If we just had that melting, just, you know, the solar warming, then that would take a long time to melt and disappear. However, what's happening today is that Greenland is literally being split open with pools of water sinking down to the bottom of the ocean. They're called moulons. And this water trickling down through the ice sheet, through big cracks, is lubricating the bottom. And as a consequence, huge amounts of ice are being discharged off. This is an old picture several years ago, more than a decade. You would see ice sheets discharges moving at this speed. Today, the discharge of these icebergs is 40 times that amount. 40 times. Again, totally unexpected. Okay, now the other trivial pursuit question is, suppose Greenland melts, all of it. How high will the sea level rise globally? You should know this, Vanessa. Do you remember from 220? No? Anybody else? 10 meters? 3 meters? How many? You say 3? Who says something else? 1? Anything else? No, it's higher. It's going to be 7 meters. So then around the coffee table, dining table at McGill Faculty Club, well, it says, what's the sea level of Montreal? Do you know? It's only about 25 feet. That's about 7, 8 meters. So we're going to have an ocean around us, you know, if Greenland melts. Think of that.
How many meters did you say it would rise?
7 meters globally. 7 meters. So that's 20, 25 feet. Sorry, I'm not supposed to stand in front of the camera. But this, you say, will take thousands of years. That's what we thought, that it would take thousands of years. But now, with the rate of these discharges, this could happen in a couple of hundred years. I'll stand to be corrected, but I think this could happen in a couple hundred years. At the rate at which these icebergs are discharging is just enormous. Okay, has it happened in the past? Oh yeah, that's what it looks like. Okay, so these things come off. Another test for you, how big is that iceberg? Okay, it weighs 300 million tons. Okay, that's big, that's a lot of ice there, a lot of fresh water. Okay, here's Florida under a 6-meter sea level rise. How many go to Florida in the wintertime for holidays? Okay, I hope you bought real estate inland and not on the coast, because you're going to have big problems there. So, all these famous resorts here, I know my daughter had a holiday somewhere down here, so she'd be flooded all of here, and yeah, most of Florida along Georgia, bad news. So that's what's happened with the 6-meter sea level rise. 40% of the world live, you know, within just meters of the sea level. So you can imagine the tremendous disruption if Greenland indeed melts. Not just 6 meters, even if you get 1 or 2 meters sea level rise. In the past, warm period, the last interglacier 130,000 years ago, it was believed that there was much less ice in Greenland. It was a bit warmer. So there's one possible configuration. Here's another configuration. And those configurations led to 2 and 3 meter rises in sea level. So that happened just naturally because it was a warmer period during the last interglacial. So we're now in also a warm period, and if that warm period persists, I can bet your last dollar that we're going to see a lot less ice in Greenland. So a little bit of exaggeration perhaps, but with the sea level rise, we'll be using a lot more boat taxis than we are today. Certainly in Montreal you would be, I guess. Okay, the next 100,000 years, K is for 1,000 years. I'm also interested in paleoclimate, trying to look at the past and using what we know and about the past to try and forecast the future. I mentioned that there are these orbital parameters. The eccentricity is the shape of the orbit, elliptical or not. So this high eccentricity means a more elliptical shape, and when it's down here, it's not so elliptical. You can see that these peaks here are roughly... these are 200,000 years. Those peaks are roughly 100,000 years apart. And that's sort of the periodicity of the Ice Age cycles. But what I didn't realize until I got into this subject was that on top of this 100,000 year cycle, there's also a 400,000 year cycle. And that is extremely important because we're going from a very high period, yes, we're going through some wiggles, to a very low period here. And this has tremendous impact on how the Earth receives its solar energy. And what happened at this peak here is that there was a big drop in the insolation. So this is the insolation, the amount of heat coming to the Earth's surface. So there's a big drop at 130,000 years ago, and that's what precipitated the last ice age, this huge drop in insolation. And it happened because of the tilt being large and also because of this high eccentricity. But now, today, we are zero here, that's the present, and we're dropping to nearly a completely circular orbit. And the upshot is that the drop here that we experienced is only half what we have here. And normally, you'd think this would lead us into an ice age, but it has not. So what you see here is the last ice age, the warm period, ice age, warm period, and models done by Berger and Lutre using a simple climate model, they show that, indeed, if you just went into the future with the CO2 from the ice cores of the past, then, indeed, the natural climate cycle would be 50,000 years of continuing interglacial period. So it's really quite remarkable. We tend to think of the interglacials as always being short, you know, 10, 15,000 years. But now, because of this 400,000-year change in the orbital parameters, the ice age under natural conditions would continue at least for 50,000 years. I find that fascinating. And I think the question is, okay, what if we now add the mix of CO2 to this? So I'm talking about CO2 going up and down between 280 and 180. Now, in fact, if by some miracle we could get the CO2 down to 210 parts per million, so just a little bit, quite a bit below the pre-industrial, then indeed we would go into an ice age. So the low CO2 together with the orbital configuration, would give us another ice age immediately. So I got fascinated by this, and with a brilliant student from France, Ecole Polytechnique, and my other collaborators, we modeled the future climate over the next 100,000 years. And we did various scenarios of CO2 starting, you know, from today. And what we found that if the CO2 in our climate model was in this range of 240 to 270, so just below the pre-industrial values, then indeed we would go into an ice age immediately. So, bingo, in a few hundreds of years, 10,000 years certainly, we'd be ice covered again. Our model showed, though, if we had just a little bit more CO2, 280 to 290, we would indeed delay the ice age for 50,000 years. And if we were at 300,000, we would have no ice age for the next 100,000 years. Now, the nice thing about science is you have collaborators, you have friends around the world, but you're not always talking to your friends. You're working away, beavering away, your graduate students are really doing excellent work, and then you meet them at a conference. And then they show you some results. And what they show you is that, I'm going to skip that for the moment, they show you some results and say, by golly, you got that? Well, we got very similar results in our research. So what they found was that under the natural process, as we were looking at earlier, these are the interglacials. Someone else by the name of Archer and Ganapolsky from Chicago and Potsdam, Germany, they found that the interglacial indeed was going to be quite long, just as we found. But they found that if they released more and more CO2 into the atmosphere, then we would prolong the interglacial periods. And if we look at this picture, 5,000 gigatons of carbon, so that's burning all our fossil fuels, then it produces over 500 million years. It produces a very, very long interglacial. So if we don't want to have any more ice ages, that's fine. We're going to do it. And that is apparently what is happening. And we're therefore defining the present period, which we call the Holocene. We're redefining that as the Anthropocene, our own impact on climate, because we're going to produce these ice ages, because we're going to burn all the fossil fuels, let's face it. Until we find other energy sources, we're going to do that. Well, just going back quickly, we said, what happens if you have a global warming period? This is continuing the work of this lady. Put in a lot of CO2 and then let it come down. Then what happens? And sure enough, we showed that in our model, we found that there were no ice ages immediately, but the ice ages that would have started at 280, 290 would again start as before, and nothing for 100,000 years if we had 300 parts per million. So we are indeed entering a very new climate era, and it's going to be very hard, I think, for us to do anything to get us back to sort of more normal conditions. What is normal? Well, the new normal is we are in a warmer climate, and the new normal, I think, is that we'll never have any more ice ages. But along with this, we're also going to have tremendous impacts. Now, let's see if I got this right. Yeah, so the impacts are on sea level rise. To me, that's the biggest problem of all, the sea level rise. The environmental, political refugees, forget political refugees, it's going to be environmental refugees. It's going to be a huge problem. With the melting of ice sheets in the Rockies, for example, or in Asia, a lot of the store of fresh water that people use to live is going to disappear. So we're going to have tremendous water problems. Forests are certainly going to move north, but as the forests warm, they're susceptible to disease, and you've all heard of the pine bark beetles in the western forests. Because of the warm winters, the pine beetles are killing off a lot of the forests. Health-related diseases, there can be an import of infectious diseases from low latitudes and so on. So there are many impacts, and certainly the coastal areas are one that I very much am concerned about with sea level rise. It's been predicted that the Arctic will be ice-free during summer, so these are some model studies from the National Center for Atmospheric Research showing that around 2030, we indeed could have, in summertime, this green curve here would represent what the ice would look like at that time. So the Arctic sea ice is indeed very much changing. It's getting thinner, it's getting mushier, and in the summertime it could disappear. And I don't particularly love polar bears. They're very vicious creatures. I was up in Baffin Bay a few years ago on a cruise and got in some zodiacs and went to observe these bears in some islands. And if you ever see these things fight, they're the most vicious creatures you can imagine. So I saw a couple of polar bears tearing themselves apart. But nevertheless, apart from that, they do need ice to live on. They need it in Hudson Bay to feed from. And without ice, they're going to have to move somewhere else. Come down to Montreal, I don't know. This is a fascinating study by Bouten from University of Alberta. He showed that there's even a genetic change induced by climate change, that these squirrels are suddenly much more active sexually when the warm climate. So they're breeding much more earlier because of the climate change in the Yukon. So I guess we'll have more squirrels in Montreal, as if we haven't got enough already. Well, the conveyor belt. Remember I talked about the conveyor belt. During the Ice Age, when you had those big armadas of icebergs, slowed down the THC and the climate cooled. Well, maybe that's a good effect. Maybe we will be able to slow down the thermohaline circulation with a lot of fresh water, a lot of melting of ice at high latitudes. However, that's not going to affect the climate globally. It could produce a colder Europe for a while, but it will not impact on the global temperature. Okay, I want to have a few minutes for questions. So we are having a major impact on climate. Warming will continue for decades, if not centuries. I think it's going to be very hard for us to cut down our greenhouse gas emissions. And I've not gone into the great detail, but people argue that maybe we're going to have more extreme events. And it's simply because if you have the bell curve of the present-day climate like this, you're always going to have extremes. But if that bell curve shifts to a higher value, then those extremes are also going to be there as well in a different location. So I think the extremes are going to be worse. We're certainly going to have more rainy weather at high latitudes, that's for sure. Geographical expansion of tropical diseases, water shortages, I've mentioned, and inundation of coastal cities, a factor which I'm very much concerned with. And the long term, if the CO2 could miraculously drop, then we could return to another ice age. So this is the history of paleoclimate. However, if we continue our emissions, we'll probably never have another ice age as we know it, and we will be in a new era known as the Anthropocene. Okay, I conclude there, and I'll be very happy for questions. Thank you.
If there are any questions, there are mics in front of everyone. Press the red button, the light will go on, and then you can ask your question. We're open.
I'm glad to see they're all climate believers here.
Lawrence?
Yes, where are we?
So a decade or two ago, I'm hiding out.
Sorry, John.
There were those in the field, including your old colleague, Roddy Rogers, who had reservations about all this modeling because of great uncertainty about cloud adsorption and radio reflection. Mm-hmm. And has that all been sorted out now?
Well, it's still a big problem. We've got an expert right in the front row who could probably answer that question better than I. But in defense of saying whether that's important or not, because of our success with paleoclimate models where we knew nothing about clouds in the past, yes, they probably do go up and down, but I don't think it's been a major problem in terms of major climate changes. But for the future, yes, who knows? There could be some subtle differences. I don't know if you want to comment on this at all.
Well, just quickly, I don't have an answer. I think that's why we still keep a job.
Still employed, yeah. Keep it in the clouds and we'll still be employed. Question there at the back?
Okay, I don't have any technical experience or insight except for what I read in the popular press, but I am very concerned about the future of this planet. Mm-hmm. And there's so much controversy about whether what we're doing is having an impact or it's not having an impact. Obviously, we are having a big impact.
I hope you believe that. Yeah.
I believe that we're having a big impact. I was just wondering about the health of our oceans and if you could tell us anything about that.
Yeah, I didn't go into that. Yeah, we are. The oceans are becoming more acidic. That is definitely true. This because the CO2 does go into the oceans. So the oceans are becoming more acidic. And again, looking at past oceans, we can see that that can have a disastrous effect. It can dissolve, you know, the hard-shelled little plankton and so on. So an acidic ocean is not a healthy ocean, that is true. And that is certainly taking place today. Short answer to your question.
Okay, well, I have a lot of other questions, but I'll give okay. the floor to someone else. Thank you.
On a small scale, you know, we see that quite a gloomy picture, but there are some steps we're taking. For example, the impact of recycling yes. programs, however, reforestation, conserving green space, and so on. But we seem to be stuck. We have an ocean that's being forever polluted with refuse, mm-hmm. and therefore that is changing the vegetation or the mass, the carbonic mass in there, which impacts it. But as a guideline to people who want to do something like recycling or reforestation, where do we go? Do we bring in trees that are more susceptible to one climate or another? How do you forecast?
Yeah, what do we do as a citizen? Well, we need four televisions, for example. I mean, we are a consumer society. Do we need a big house? And no, we don't. I mean, I'm still living in a huge house, far too more than I need. So I think it is very much a personal thing that we have to rethink how we live. We certainly have to rethink transportation. I know there's this tremendous battle, even in Montreal, you know, all the offshore people, and yet we're building more roads, and yet the government says, no, we want to be more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. So there's so many contradictions out there, but I think it has to start at the community and the individual level. And that brings to mind two books I brought with me. One is written just recently. It's called Generation Us, The Challenge of Global Warming. And it's written by Andrew Weaver, who happens to be one of my PhD students, former PhD students when I was at UBC. And he's very much wrote this book. It's called A Quick Read. And indeed, I read it on an airplane flight from Vancouver to Montreal twice over. And I just would like to read the last few lines what he writes in his book about the Generation Us. And I quote, "Global warming has been branded an environmental problem, but it is really an economic and social problem. We've spent too much time living within a culture of global warming fear and denial. It's time to recognize global warming for what it is, the most self-empowering issue that we will ever face. Every consumer of energy is part of the problem. Every person is therefore part of the solution. We are entering an age of creative innovation, unlike any other modern society that has experienced before. Rather than fearing this change, we need to embrace it, and change starts in each and every one of our households. So the time is now." So I think recycling, consumption, transportation changes. I've been in Europe many times on sabbaticals, and it always amazes me, you know, how good the transportation is. And as a network, I've spent many years in Switzerland off and on. And there's just one transportation system there. And I was just reading this morning the papers, there's about 17 transportation systems in Montreal. Just a pain in the butt, you know, with 70 different charges, you know, wherever you go. So we're sort of fighting ourselves, it seems, where we could be, you know, making transportation much easier. And, you know, I can put tickets on my card to take the train, but I can't get a separate set of tickets for the bus only. So these sort of annoying things show that, yes, we talk about things we can do, but somehow, collectively, we're not working very well at it. In terms of forestation and so on, yes, that is very helpful. You know, changing our forests and crops. We certainly have to change our crops as the land surfaces change. And I come from a family of farmers two generations back, and I know my my uncle, I guess, he was the last one to farm. He was changing his crops over the last 30 years. Question over here. Can you push on the light, please? No, you press a button to get a red light.
This is more a small scale, but I think that so much of the earth, the water that grows the rice and you know, waters the Bangladesh and the India and all these places, is water that's coming from mountains, right? From stored snow caps, etc. Are those mountaintops also doomed to? I mean, due to be much thinner in the future? Will there be a whole different cycle of rainfall, for example?
Yes.
Because I understand that in some places, the way that people were living, if the rains come too strongly from the monsoon and all that, it just washes all the soil away anyway.
That's a very big problem, but we don't even have to go that far. Just go to the Canadian Rockies. I don't know if you've ever seen the glacier, glacier ice feeds, I guess they are, on the Banff Jasper Highway. And those ice sheets have gone back, you know, kilometers and kilometers from when I saw them as a kid. I grew up in Alberta. So I remember those ice sheets are right down to the highway, and now I have to drive miles to get to them. So we're losing the ice very much, so tremendous water problems are going to impact on the prairies for sure. So it is a real issue, absolutely. There's one other book I brought with me, and it's also on this reference sheet. Happy to take that sheet. It's called Science as a Contact Sport. And this is written by the late Stephen Schneider. It's his autobiography. I think it was published in 2009. He unfortunately died in 2010. But he was very much a political activist, a great scientist as well. And he really tried to put the story correctly in the press in the United States. He was at Stanford University. And he certainly lost many battles, but he also had many very good battles. And so he's one of the great public proponents of trying to explain climate change to people. So I think you'd enjoy this book, Science as a Contact Sport. Question over here.
Just a question. Have you been asked to do this presentation in international fora or on Parliament Hill? Are you being listened to and received?
Well, I'm hoping by giving the message to you that you'll carry it on to Parliament Hill. No, my students are doing people like Andrew Weaver, who's my student, and my postdoc, Thomas Stocker, he's in charge of IPCC. So I saw him on BBC television. So it's my children who are doing it and not me. I mean, I used to do it when I was younger. When I was president of the Academy of Science in Canada, I tried to talk to politicians, but it was a hopeless task, quite frankly. Well, Canada withdrew, right? I think we have to come to agreement. But with the present government, their mission is elsewhere. Everything's the economy. We cannot touch the economy. Whereas I think if you really think of the future, if you don't act now, it's just going to get worse. But they won't accept this. So what can you do? Anyway, I just would say I'd be very happy to give this lecture to any public interest group or any community group. It is sort of very easy to carry around my little memory stick. You just provide the laptop and I'll come. Free of charge. Question over here, yes.
There's quite a lot of carbon in the boreal forest. And as the climate warms up, the boreal forest will get drier. There'll be more forest fires. Do your models include those kind of natural positive
feedback?
There are
now some studies dealing with forest fires, sort of natural and induced forest fires. My models, I didn't study this myself, but I know people do work on the effect of forest fires, yes. The other factor, of course, is the permafrost changes. It warms at the high latitudes, the permafrost will melt and be releasing methane. So people are also examining that issue, and that'll only accelerate the changes.
So what you've presented could be, in fact, be
this is a sort of very conservative presentation, right, if you like, of what it could happen in the future. Just like the early models did not really look at the full sea level problem. They only looked at sort of the thermal expansion and maybe a few melting of glaciers on mountains. But the impact of Greenland melting was not studied before, but it will be in the next assessment. Mm-hmm. That is for sure. They realized there was a big shortcoming there.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes, my question relates to the relationship between politics and science. Why was it such a success? Why was it so easy to convince politicians that the destruction of the ozone layer was an important thing to solve, an important problem? Is it because scientists are no longer listened to by politicians, or is it because the economic implications of global warming and the energy business is...
Well, I think the ozone problem is a very good one. There was a Montreal Protocol in 1997, and ozone was clear. You got cancer if you didn't have ozone, right? That absorbed the ultraviolet radiation. So it's a very personal thing. So if you can convert that to something today, well, it's hard to say. The sea level rise is the best one that I can argue. And there are countries now really being impacted on sea level rise. So I think if we get another meter of sea level rise, I think that would really get the politician to think. But again, if that's 50 years down the road, it's too long away. So I'd be very interested to hear any suggestions of what we could bring to the public more. Certainly the forestry industry in the West was affected very much by the beetles, which grew in the or lived through the winter. And my son's a forest engineer, so he's left the forestry. He works as an engineer rather than as a forestry person, and because you know, the forest industry is really was cut down in the West. Yes.
One of the things they say we should use is geothermal energy.
Good point. Yes.
Are there any hidden downsides to geothermal? If people caught on to that in a big way, mm-hmm. what is the impact of taking heat from the center of the Earth?
There's a lot of heat because it's all nuclear down there, right? In the center of the Earth is just nuclear bombs going off continuously. So there's a lot of energy. And countries like Iceland, you know, live on geothermal energy. So, yes, we could be exploiting that. Again, it's a decision factor and providing incentive to using more energy sources like that. I mean, we are now using, of course, more wind power, but people say, not in my backyard, all those ready windmills, you know, in the backyard. But geothermal, I think, is something that could be exploited more. Even also energy from the ocean is being thought of, bringing up heat from the not too far below the surface, but using the heat in the ocean to heat coastal cities.
In the future, what regions of the planet do you think will be safe to live in? What countries are...
Well, I guess if you're landlocked, you're not going to worry about sea level rise. Certainly the lower latitudes don't experience as great of change as the high latitudes. So I guess middle to low latitudes away from the coast will be pretty safe.
So like Brazil or?
Brazil has a lot of ocean and has a lot of forests being destroyed, of course, so it's have an impact there. And I think because of the change in forest, the hydrological cycle is also changing there. So it may not be such a good place. Maybe Argentina is a little bit better.
Thank you.
I have one.
Yes.
I have one. So do you think we're heading towards this 2 degree that following good standards of CO2 emissions, that we might only be looking at a 2 degree change mm-hmm. In the future, in the next century. Do you think we're heading that way, or we're more heading towards the 4 degrees?
The higher standard.
Yeah.
I think we're heading for the higher one, unless there's really new energy sources being developed and we can sequester a lot of the CO2. I mean, again, we always think of the technological fix, so maybe there's ways we can actually extract CO2 from the atmosphere and bury it down below. And, of course, that's the argument I've heard from engineers in Alberta. The dean of engineering at U of Alberta, a guy called Lynch, had a big article in the Globe and Mail saying, look, we are, you know, the masters of CO2 sequestration. So if we could really get it down, but to really make a big impact, we'd almost have to draw down our CO2 emissions to about 10% of what they are today, and then we would, you know, keep the temperature down to between 1 and 2 degrees. So sort of doing the inverse problem. And Damon Matthews, who's my grandson academically, has worked on this problem at Concordia University.
And do these models take into account the growth of the population, or
only through the emissions that we put in? So in that sense, we do, because we are putting in 10 billion. Gigatons of carbon instead of 7 billion tons. So in that sense, we are. But in terms of, land use change and so on, there's obviously an impact with more people there. And there's some of that going on, but not enough.
Lawrence, I know that there are probably many more questions, but we've tried to finish officially at 1:30. So on behalf of everyone who's here, on behalf of the campus community, I want to really thank you very much for having presented to us today.
Thank you.
And certainly having sent to us a message that we are going to be responsible for our own destiny with respect to climate, and we had better act in whatever ways we can to improve the situation. Just as a last comment, the next get-together of the Campus Community Committee is on February 28th. We did send out a notice today. This is a just-come-together party, no speeches, at the Faculty Club, beginning at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 to 7. Music will be provided, food will be provided, and the music will be provided by the Diminished Faculty, which is a band formed of faculty members of the university, including some deans. So please, I invite everybody to join us February the 28th at 4 o'clock at the Faculty Club. And again, Professor Mizak, thank you so much for today.
If you want any references, right here. Just come and help yourself.